The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest calls it Hidden America. They're the people who make sure there's power when we flip a light switch, the people who raise, grow, and gather the food we buy at the grocery store, who take care of the copious amount of waste each of us as Americans produce. Award-winning journalist Jean Marie Laskus takes us into these worlds of an Ohio coal mine, a Texas beef ranch, a migrant labor camp in Maine, the air traffic control tower at LaGuardia, an Alaskan oil rig, or a landfill in California. These hidden American stories will make any talk of makers and takers seem pretty petty and small-minded. Laskus writes of a tremendous American work ethic, alive and well, and a workforce that just wants a job to do in her book, Hidden America, From Coal Miners to Cowboys, An Extraordinary Exploration of the Unseen People Who Make This Country Work. It's published by Putnam. It's extraordinary portraits of ordinary American workers. Jean Marie Laskus is a director of the writing program at the University of Pittsburgh, where she also teaches creative writing. She's the author of 5 previous books, and for 20 years she's been writing for national magazines. Currently, she is a correspondent for GQ. She's also written for Esquire, Smithsonian Magazine, The Washington Post Magazine, and now The New York Times Magazine. Her book is titled Hidden America. Jean Marie Laskus joins us by phone. Jean Marie Laskus, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
This book, Hidden America, you said you wanted to know more about the people that do unseen jobs in this country. Give us a sense of what you were trying to do with this book.
Well, speaking of unseen jobs, the idea came to me when I was in a coal mine in eastern Ohio with a bunch of miners, and noting that I didn't even realize coal mining still went on so regularly, to say nothing of how dependent we are on coal. You know, every single time we flip a light switch, we burn a lump of coal. So I wanted to find out sort of what else we're dependent on and who are the people doing the work that bring us that.
And you chose some unusual occupations. I mean, obviously some are very obvious. Cowboys, there are still cowboys, as we all know, and they're helping put meat on the table. Truck drivers deliver us our goods. Landfill workers basically take all of our debris that we waste and get rid of it for us. But there were some that were unusual. One was like, I have to ask about the cheerleaders. You did a story on the Bengals. This is the Cincinnati Bengals cheerleaders. Now, why would you want to tell their story?
Well, the Bengals, you know, I wanted to touch on somewhere in this book the culture of celebrity. And how could I get at celebrity in the periphery the same way that all these jobs are in the periphery and are sort of hidden? So, you know, that was a big challenge for me, to even think about how to approach that, because you just think, okay, you know, a celebrity is someone you obviously know about, but there are celebrities you don't really know about, or you see on literally the sidelines. So here come these cheerleaders who we think we know everything about. You know, they stand for what we believe all little girls at one point aspire to become, one way or the other, and here they are. And first of all, do you know how much an NFL cheerleader gets paid per game?
I'm thinking it's probably something very low.
$75 per game.
Right.
That just blew me away to begin with. It's like the one actor in our most celebrated entertainment empire who gets literally nothing. Well, barely anything in exchange.
If they're lucky, they get a nice camera shot for about 3 seconds.
Yeah, that would be a huge gift. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's like, what are they doing there? Who are these people? And I spent a season with that squad, and you discover they're not who you think they will be.
What was the biggest surprise?
I'd say the main character, Adrian, who I write about, they all have other jobs. And hers was, she was a cement pourer, and she poured the cement in Paul Brown Stadium. You know, she was cheering on top of that cement, that very cement, and her connection to that stadium.
And, of course, they're really just a sidelight to the game. I mean, everybody's watching the game. You might, your eyes might drift down to the cheerleaders when the action gets, you know, when there's a break in the action. But that's really about it. I mean, it's almost like they're there for television as a sort of, just a cutaway shot in many cases.
Yeah, but they sure don't see it that way. And it's, just, you know, it's a culture unto itself that really has nothing to do with the players. They're not even allowed to fraternize or speak to the players except for at officially sanctioned events. So it's an entirely separate culture, and they do it for reasons that is all about the sense of personal gratification and a kind of a sense of service. I know
right.
That's hard. It's hard to sell that in a soundbite, but you know that's one of the things I write about. They have a sense of their power over men. You know, we think that we objectify them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you know that power they wield over men, they think is quite hilarious.
Let's go back to the notion of hidden America. One of the things I really found interesting is this, you know, maybe in Oklahoma we have a little more connection. We have a lot more blue-collar jobs. But still, most of us really don't have a connection to a lot of these jobs most Americans maybe did a generation ago or maybe two generations ago.
Yeah, I do think that once upon a time in a pre-industrial America, we were quite connected to all these folks, you know. Our grandparents or great-grandparents, you know, I mean, you had Uncle Charlie, you know, milking the cows, and your beef came from somewhere down the road, and you knew the characters attached to the stuff of everyday life. In some cases, even digging the coal in a neighborhood, taking the trash out to this dump down the road. You had a connection to sort of everything. We've lost that in our sanitized world, you know, mostly for the better. Who wants to be taking their trash down to the dump? Mostly for the better, but what we've lost in that process is a sense of the neighborhood we are, in fact, in, you know, whether we realize it or not. And one of the things I think that this book does is, or did for me in the research, is connect me to these people. And I feel more a part of things now than I had, instead of, you know, that sense of just being a consumer, taking, taking, taking. Knowing how stuff works and knowing the people who do it kind of connects you to that larger whole.
Now, was the when you spent time at the Hopedale Mine in Cadiz, Ohio, was that your first real experience in some of these occupations? Was that the first experience that shows up in the book?
That was the first experience for this book, definitely, uh-huh. Yes.
Yeah, and it was really an amazing sense of discovery that seemed to pop up every day as you were learning about that mine. And it also sort of played you well as you went through these other occupations. I think our mindset would be, you know, you're working in a mine. It's all about the fact that, you know, your health is deteriorating because you're in a very unhealthy environment. You're in very cramped space. But these guys just don't complain. And what's really interesting is, you know, we talk about the American work ethic. These guys are like, how much coal can we produce today? You know, I mean, it's all about work ethic.
About work ethic.
And you found that pretty much across the board, too.
I sure did. I did not find a whiny community of, oh, I just want to stay home and drink at all. And not that I was looking for anything of the sort, but the cliche you would even see on TV, maybe, of the blue-collar kind of family or worker, that just didn't exist in any of my research. And the coal miners, you know, it's not that they're heroic. You know, they are down there 10 hours a day in conditions that are so very extreme, you and I can't imagine it. I mean, you know, it's only 5 feet high, the coal mine I was in, first of all. They're hunched over all day in the absolute pitch darkness, except for a pinpoint of light, in where ventilation is your primary, you know, fresh air is mostly what you're thinking about for 10 hours a day. and it's all explosive. Just to add that on top, and might collapse at any moment, and has collapsed on, you know, probably your uncle or your father or your friend.
Right. And he said the tunnels are basically as wide as the coal seam. There's no use in taking out rock to, you know, make, so if the coal seam's 3 foot, the tunnel's 3 foot. If it's 5 foot, as it was in your case, it was 5 foot.
Correct. You know, I kept asking the dumbest questions, you know, like, why don't they make the roof higher? Why is the ceiling so low? You know, there are people working down here. Just make a higher ceiling. And, you know, immediately they explained to me, listen, lady, a coal seam is a coal seam. We don't mine below it. We'll hit water or above it. We may hit rock. You know, we got to just take the coal.
And the first time you went down there, you were very surprised because it's white.
Well, isn't that ridiculous? Honestly, I thought it was a joke. You get to the bottom, you come off this elevator, and the whole thing is white. But the fact is, because it's exposed coal is explosive, it's gunpowder, you know, the minute you take a chunk of coal out, you throw the remaining surface, you put what's called, well, a limestone product, rock dust, over it so that it will retard the, you know, the explosion. So the net result is the whole thing is white.
We think of a coal mine as being a quiet, dark place, and it can be at times, but it also is, you have a great sense of the movement within the earth. You said you can hear creaking, you can hear steam, you know, I guess methane vents sort of popping up. It sounds like it's an otherworldly environment.
Yeah, that was another surprise. You think, you know, we all think of the earth as like this big dumb rock we're standing on, you know, if we ever think of it at all. But, you know, inside it's alive. I mean, it's moving, it's hissing, it's, who knew? I mean, it was extraordinary to sit there in a moment of just, you know, all machinery off and that kind of silence, and then to just listen.
In the course of meeting these coal miners, what was interesting was nearly all of them are farmers, too.
Well, and that really was the main event for this community I was with. You know, the coal mines of Appalachia have reopened in the last, I would say, 5 years, or maybe decade even. Because of new technologies on how to get coal, which has brought people, you know, home. The family farms that exist in that part of the country, you can't make a living as a small family farmer anymore. You have to do something. And the coal mines allowed these people to hold on to their farms. And, you know, the main character in that chapter, his name is Foot, is his nickname. He was all day in the coal mine. And then as soon as he got out, he was tending to his fields. And, you know, the fields are what mattered to him and his cattle.
And when you go out and drink with them, they're talking about how good a miner they are, how much coal they get out of the seam that they're working that day. It's all about the job.
Yeah, they brag rightly about the job and how good they are at it and how good they are at the machinery. I mean, I'd give him every ounce of that those bragging rights because it was just really extraordinary. And I found that in other cultures, too. I mean, air traffic controllers, there's a world that's not exactly blue-collar, but the same ethic of that work ethic, extraordinary work ethic that I saw with the coal miners.
Yeah, I guess the point I'm trying to get across is, you know, we hear a lot of our political discourse talking about the eroding American work ethic. And I don't think it's necessarily the work ethic. It's the job providers.
Yeah, that's really frustrating for me to listen to now these, first of all, really abstract conversations about who the American worker is and what jobs are and who does these jobs and what they think of them. This research has made those abstract conversations really concrete. And I see this trucker who I went across the country with, a woman trucker who, you know, not one ounce of complaint. Talk about a work ethic. I mean, it's alive and well in America. I'm just happy to report.
Right. Now you do go from coal mining to a migrant worker camp. Now, this is a situation where native-born Americans pretty much have said, we don't want to do this anymore. Not to say that they don't want to work hard at the job that they want to do, but this is a job they no longer want to do, and this is what was pointed out in that piece, I think.
Absolutely, and this is where it gets complicated, because here you have now all this labor that we're importing, you know, whether we want to recognize that it's happening, you know, illegally or not, and under the radar, which, first of all, is an old, old, old ancient story, if you look at the history of this country and who did... A lot of the picking of a lot of food, you know, it was the Chinese, it was the Japanese, it was, you know, on and on and on. Here we are now with South American countries and Mexico coming up about the border. And, you know, farmer after farmer after farmer telling me, well, good thing they're here because this fruit would rot. There's no one to pick it.
Now, you were in Maine during blueberry season.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually rake the plants to actually fill the baskets.
Correct.
And I guess, what, about a decade or 15 or 20 years ago, this was a community sort of thing.
Yes. This small, well, first of all, people owned these much smaller farms, and their cousins and brothers and sisters, and everyone came out for blueberry season. And there's a blueberry festival, and it was all part of that kind of neighbor, helping neighbor culture that does not exist anymore. And
is it the fact that most of those small farms have been bought up by commercial interests that have changed maybe the perception of the people there?
I would. That is my guess. That is my observation. But there is also added to that, a lot of people say, well, what's the matter with these lazy teenagers? They, you know, or these lazy people, Americans, they won't go out and pick the fruit. It is such hard work, and it pays squat. And you have to then look at the larger picture and say, okay, wait a minute. If we're going to pay a living wage for these people, for anyone to pick our food, where is that money going to come from? It's going to get translated ultimately to the consumer. You know, are we willing to pay $30 a pound for blueberries?
Or even 15.
Or even 15. It's like, we're not 10. Willing to pay this.
Yeah.
We're all complicit in this situation. Is one of the, you know, as consumers, we're complicit in this too. So it's just too easy to blame, the workers, the migrant workers, the farmers. You know, it's just too easy to throw blame. We're all complicit in this situation. And again, that's where I come away with this sense of, okay, we're all part of this neighborhood.
And you describe this stream of migrant workers. They start in Florida. They start in Southern California. Those groups will move up the coastline, up through Oregon, through Washington, and then maybe over into the Dakotas. There's another branch that starts in South Texas and moves their way up through Oklahoma here and then through the plains all the way up to the Canadian border. And another that starts in Florida and works their way up the eastern seaboard and ends up in Maine.
Correct.
And Maine is probably one of the better, most of the migrants that you talked to said this is one of the better jobs. Picking blueberries is better money than most.
Yes.
And better working conditions.
That was their favorite crop. That was the one, that was the bonus. That was like your August bonus round. Get up to Maine. They would describe this camp as better than any other that they stayed in. And let me tell you, it is a camp in every sense of the word. I mean, there are plywood cabins there and running water, but nothing else. And yet they really were grateful for this work because of the $2.25 per box that they were able to rake. That compared very well to picking apples and oranges and other crops.
And they were also in a situation where they could pick as much as they wanted at their rate.
Yes.
As opposed to some quota and being sort of, you know, I guess, overseered.
Yeah, that was kind of surprisingly humane. Because it was very, very, very hot, and it's very hard work. And some of the people, you know, they were old guys and old women. And if all they could do was, you know, rake three boxes that day, that was just fine. You know, give it over to the other folks. They were just enough people to make it all happen, and you could just do as much as you were capable of doing.
My guest today is Jean Marie Laskus, a correspondent for GQ and director of the writing program at the University of Pittsburgh. Her book is titled Hidden America, From Coal Miners to Cowboys, an Extraordinary Exploration of the Unseen People Who Make This Country Work. It's published by Putnam, and it's really these wonderful essays on these occupations we know are out there, but we just don't ever think about. And one of the ones we don't think about a lot, which really matter to us when we use it, is the air traffic control. You wrote about that. You went to LaGuardia, which is probably one of the, it's got to be one of the most busiest towers and one of the most stressful occupations. And again, getting back to work ethic, these guys were, they were in the shoes of their passengers. They wear very closely how much, I mean, I think one guy said, you know, what is a heart surgeon? He's got maybe one, two lives a day. We have 150, 200 times how many planes we're tracking through the day. Mm. And they take that very seriously.
I love that heart surgeon. So many of the controllers compared themselves to heart surgeons. It was astounding to think about. And frankly, when I'm now in an airplane, a lot of people ask me, well, aren't you afraid now that you've spent all that time up in the tower where you can see how it really works? I'll tell you what, I'm comforted to know it's almost like they're guardian angels watching over every step of the way where that plane goes. You know, it's like there's someone out there watching and making sure everything happens just on time, just in the nick of time. And I'm up there and I think, well, thank God Brian's down there. You know, I know this one's coming in You know, it's but it's just amazing the stress of that job, unlike any of the others I saw. The immediacy of firing decision after decision after decision, just you know, without a moment to think, such that they would have to take a break after like 30 minutes. You had to stop and get your brain back, and then you, it's called plugging in. When you put your headset back in, you could plug in again. So there was a constantly rotating team of people plugging in, plugging out, plugging in, plugging out.
And how many times have we been on aircraft where there's like one set of passengers that are just slowing down the whole process and boarding takes way longer than it should? Those guys are feeling that decision because they've already figured that that plane's supposed to be out of the gate at this point, and if it's not, it's messing up the whole ballet that they're doing.
Yes, exactly. It is a ballet. Yeah, and that part's out of their control, and that will make them nuts. Also, certain aircraft, like American MD-80s, for some reason, are slower to get up to the takeoff position than all other aircraft. So they have to, you know, they would just say, oh, my God, it's an American MD-80. We're just going to have to slow everything down now. You know, it's just like just all this nuance that you couldn't even ever imagine.
And yet, when they're not plugged in, they have one of the most dysfunctional work situations ever. They're still working on equipment that is, what, 25, 30 years old. They're working in conditions where, you know, the union and the management of the FAA have been at loggerheads really since the Reagan strike. I mean, I don't think they've ever been really reconciled since that point in 81. They have tremendous job turnover coming over because all those people that started after the firing of the air traffic controllers in 81, they're all at retirement age. And what used to be a college graduate job is now being opened up to a lot more people, and the training's being compressed. They're feeling the stress.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what made the controllers just nuts about this labor situation is that they've been crying about it for forever, especially this mandatory retirement. You know, everybody's aging out, and there has been no controllers in the pipeline coming up, and it takes a long time to train, a long time. And so there's this gaping hole, so everyone's having to work overtime, a lot of overtime, and you have to do it. And so the conditions with management are really strained, and they're working without a contract because they can't come to agreements, and all this overtime. You'd think they would complain, yet they don't complain to me. It wasn't like this whiny life of, oh, we hate this, ever. It was, they really saw themselves as public servants, like, well, we have to do this, you know,
and
it's our job.
And just like a good referee at a sporting event, their job is to be invisible. If they're seen, then they're messing up.
Right, and that was the other sort of cool thing about this whole project. It's like hidden America. Yeah, there are a lot of people who really prefer to be hidden. They need to be. You know, we think of this as like, you know, America, everybody wants to get rich and famous, and that's the narrative or something that's driving everyone. In fact, you know, look at the controllers. It's not about becoming rich and famous at all.
You went to a cattle ranch out in Texas, West Texas. Ever spend any time on a ranch before?
Not on purpose like this.
Other than maybe a dude ranch?
Yeah, just sort of as a tourist kind of thing. And I think that, you know, I have to tell you, this is probably not true for maybe your audience, but a lot of America, especially us out on the East Coast, had no idea that cowboys still seriously dress like cowboys and seriously ride their horses through the range all day. And no one believed me. Oh, come on, they're using ATVs and helicopters now, aren't they? I'm like, no, really, all day long, I'm on Hank, this horse.
There are times when you might use an ATV if you can, if you have the range that works for it, but a horse doesn't run out of gas. It doesn't start.
And this terrain is certainly the terrain in Texas where I was. You know, there's nothing that was going to get over that except the horses. And, you know, but the thing that surprised me about that world, because I was at a particular, like a breeding ranch, was how, of course, extremely low tech with the cowboy culture, on top of extremely high tech with the genetics, they were doing to make the perfect steak. You know, all this work in a petri dish. That surprised me.
Yeah, it's this mix of high tech and no tech.
Yes, and no tech, right?
Well, you know, when you get back to the air traffic controllers, you said there was the way they do their. They keep track of their flights. It's like it's something from the 1950s, it sounds like. You ask them, there are computers that can do this for you. And they go, nope, this is part of their redundancy system so that they're physically doing something. And it was really interesting to hear their explanation. And I think you ran into that a lot where there's this mix of high tech and low tech that seems to work for most of these occupations.
Yeah, you'd be surprised at how the high tech is not welcomed as much as you would imagine, you know, in all this work. Especially that's very clear, as you said, in the tower, the control tower. I mean, they have these like little Scrabble letter holders. That's what they look like to me. That they slide in and out of this panel. It's completely analog, you know. And then they dump in these buckets that are like from spackling or something. You know, and you can hear the clunk, and that means that plane is landed. I mean, it was auditory and tactile and all sorts of things, and the computer systems were not helping their daily life in those ways.
Well, it's a really interesting book, Hidden America, From Coal Miners to Cowboys, An Extraordinary Exploration of the Unseen People Who Make This Country Work. And you know, we talked about a little bit of the political debate, but what is your hope and aim with this book? I think I'm really tired of hearing people slag on American workers, and especially when you read this book and you see so many people working really, really hard to make ends meet, willing to do 2-3 jobs sometimes. You know, the workers, they want to work in this country. We want to work.
That's right. We hear this all the time now. What the American worker wants and what the American. Yes, the American worker wants work. That would be pretty much it, and they're willing to do it. And you know, nothing is too ridiculous. There's a chapter in there you haven't mentioned about the pipeline in Alaska.
Yes.
You know, this is crazy, and these people live and work in -45 degree weather. That's what it was when I landed up in the Prudhoe Bay in Alaska, working on an island. You know, a frozen island in the Arctic to drill oil, living in a camp, living in a tiny bubble of warmth in this camp, working 2 weeks at a time, sometimes months at a time, making a really good wage at it and willing to do it.
Yeah, but they're earning the money, aren't they?
Really, really good money. I tell my grad students, you know, they're in... They pay a lot of money to come to a grad program to learn how to write. I say, just get a job on an oil rig. You have lots of time just to write, you know. You're stuck there. You get paid a lot.
Yeah, but they earn the money. And that's the thing I think I came away with, whether it was working at the landfill, as a cheerleader, everybody's earning their money.
Earning. That's a very good way to put it. Earning, yes.
All right. Well, Jean Marie Laskus, thanks very much for your time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Jean Marie Laskus is the author of Hidden America, From Coal Miners to Cowboys, An Extraordinary Exploration of the Unseen People Who Make This Country Work. It's published by Putnam. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.